Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, thanks for tuning in. This is the Shame Free Zone, and I'm your host, Veronica Monet. And for those of you who are listening on, the appointed time, and not the archives, if you're listening what you think is live on Thursday, I apologize. I'm not actually here. This is a pre-record, and the reason being that I found some more important things to go do. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, I'm going to be giving a presentation in Napa at Brenda's little cigar shop, and I'm doing another presentation at Sonoma State University, so I apologize, but I'm out of town for a little bit. Anyhow, I have an absolutely fabulous guest tonight. This is somebody that I haven't talked to for a long, long time, but we were colleagues in the sex worker rights movement for many years, and I have a lot of other things in common, too, but I'm going to let her decide how much she wants to reveal about herself. Her name is Christine Beatty, and I'll read you a little bio of hers here. I didn't even know all this stuff, and I've known her for a couple of decades. Christine Beatty is a California girl born and raised as a boy. Now, I did know that. With her lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and sex worker activist history and ideals, Christine loves being a thorn in the side of right-wing America. She is a freelance journalist whose work has been seen in Spectator, Transistors, Beyond Definition, which is through Manic Press, 1994, Herotica 4, that's Penguin Press, 1996, and she published her own book of short stories and poetry called Misery Loves Company. She was the co-founder and lead singer for the rock group Glamazon, and she's formerly from San Francisco. She now resides in Los Angeles, and by trade, she is a software engineer and currently working on her autobiography with a literary manager. As you might well imagine, it's going to be a very interesting book. Christine, welcome to the Shame Free Zone.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
Oh, I'm just delighted to hear your voice again. My God, it's been years and years and years.
Got it out. So, remember
so
back
tired
in the
of...
old days on the Coyote Steering Committee and meeting in some little apartment there, and it was great. It was like a little family.
Well, you know, I just did an interview with a journalist from San Francisco State University. They've got a campus magazine, and it's actually a glossy one, not just an online magazine. Anyway, she was interviewing me today quite extensively, and I was telling her that whole history about Coyote and how it went through its second incarnation with our little group. And, you know, we really made quite a bit of history.
Well,
I was
thrilled to be a part of history because I remember being, and I'm really dating myself here, being 15 years old and reading the San Francisco Chronicle back in 1973. And for
that
those
only makes
you
2 years older than me, honey.
That is amazing doing math in your head. I'm about to save everybody else the history. I'm the math in their head. I'm about to turn 51 next month. So there. Anyway,
I just turned 49.
I remember reading the story in Chronicle about this woman, Margot St. James, and Coyote, and I thought, how cool. I mean, this is an awesome, really powerful woman here. I think I finished Xavier Hollander's book, The Happy Hooker, like a year before or something, sir, or not even, maybe just like 6 months before that. So I was kind of like, that's kind of interesting. And I mean, these are some really powerful women that they're mistresses of their own destiny. And little did I know, I mean, I thought I was a 15-year-old boy at the time. I mean, I had this sense of identification. I mean, you know, 10 years later, I found out why I identified so much.
Right.
But, I, you know, being 15 years old, I could never have imagined that I was going to be a woman, much less be a woman and a prostitute and a sex worker activist. So there I was. And when we hooked up together, it was 16 years after that, and I've been a sex worker and living full-time as a woman and a sex worker activist in Coyote. It's like it's gone full circle or something. It was very cool.
And you were a gorgeous blonde.
Yeah, well, I did that for the band, you know. That was,
Well, how recently did you go to brunette?
Well, this is my natural color, and it was about 6 months before I had my sex reassignment surgery, the final step in the process to give me a vagina. And I decided, you know, I'm going to be out of it for a while. I'm going to be recovering. I don't think I want all these toxins on my scalp, and I don't want roots. So, you know what? I'm just going to go back to my natural color. And really, it suits my eyes a lot better. It suits my complexion a lot better. So it was fun being blonde. I did have more fun, but, you know, I'm glad to be
back. Well, you know, same thing with me. It's interesting. We have a lot in common. I first heard about Margo St. James when I was 15. And I saw her on the Phil Donahue show. And I remember thinking, who are these uppity women? Nobody told me about them. And of course, I was immediately attracted to the whole idea. They were so outspoken and unapologetic for being so sexual.
And unashamed, exactly.
Yes, unashamed. Never encountered anything like that, you know, and it was 1975 for me. So I was just, it was like one of those moments in your life. By the time I was in my early 30s and I was the Coyote, or, you know, one of the more prominent spokespersons for the San Francisco Coyote, I'd been on CNN. Margo St. James was living in France. She saw me on there. She heard me mention Coyote and thought, well, I'll be darned. I didn't know that my organization was doing so well. Then she came back out and decided to run for city supervisor in San Francisco. And the day I met her, I remember I went to shake her hand and I said, oh, Margo, it's such an honor to meet you. And she was like, well, it's an honor to meet you too, Veronica. And I was like, oh, my God, she knows who I am. it was one of those childhood, you know, just like mm-hmm. the girl who had to kind of idolize this activist woman. And
well,
like you said,
I was honored to actually work on her campaign. We were crushed. You know, she came 7,000 votes of actually making it to the board, the supervisors. You stop and think about it. That's pretty amazing. I mean, even for San Francisco.
Well, especially since she didn't have the budget, even half the budget that the rest of the candidates had.
No, what she had was visibility, and she had a great message, and she had, you know, an electorate that was really sick of the usual clowns, you know, on the board of supervisors, and they said, you know what? I mean, this is a woman that's going to shake things up.
Absolutely, and she did, and you know, and it's well, anyway, she got the St. James Infirmary out of it. I understand it was Mayor Willie Brown's way of trying to get her to agree never to run again for office because they're so afraid of having an ex prostitute in the government.
And there was also the district attorney Terrence Hallinan's prostitution task force. And I remember Margot came back from France and then took the seat that I was vacating on the board there. Because I had to go do the band thing. And I think the only really good thing that ever came out of that prostitution task force is we got the cops to stop confiscating condoms from the streetwalkers.
I think you're right about that. You know, Terrence Hallinan actually, after the official findings of the San Francisco Task Force on Prostitution were announced, and it was recommended that San Francisco decriminalize prostitution. Terrence Hallinan, the district attorney, got on television and said, San Francisco recommends that we, you know, that prostitution be decriminalized. And then Mary Willie Brown had a fit. He's like, I am not going down in history as the mayor who, you know, legalized prostitution in San Francisco. That's just not going to happen. So he made Terrence Hallinan go back on the air and apologize.
That part I missed. I was probably really busy wrapped up in the band around about
yeah,
when
well,
that thing happened.
Politics. Politics.
Yeah.
That's why prostitution isn't legal, because of politics. And it's all about who wants to get reelected.
Well, that's why it's not legal, but I mean, really the deeper reason is we live in this puritanical, hypocritical nation where people are like fascinated by sex and yet they're ashamed of it at the same time. And you cannot get an adult conversation, I mean adult in the mature level, I mean, you know, in the mature context, from anybody, because they're just like, they turn into like they're 14 years old all over again. And people are ashamed of sex. They're ashamed of their own bodies. And if people were half ashamed as violent as they are of sex and nudity, we'd never have another war.
Oh, you know, no offense to soldiers. I actually believe that they, you know, serve a function, which I have respect for, up to a point. Up to a point. But
well, I respect
am,
the soldiers. I mean, I'm an honorably discharged veteran.
Yes, exactly, from the Air Force, right?
Yeah, exactly. I did 4 years in the Air Force. I respect the military, but it's the politicians that send them to go do things, places they shouldn't be sending them in the first place. And that's the problem, especially if it's some chicken hawk that's never really served that's sending them places. Then I get really upset.
Yeah, one of my clients was a graduate from West Point where they get that blue line or gray line or whatever, thin gray line.
If it's the Army, it's West Point.
Okay,
yeah.
I think it was in West Point, and he was a graduate of West Point, and constantly talking about how much he hated having presidents as commanders in chief who had never served. Because his feeling was that you need to have seen war firsthand before you're allowed to declare war. Because if you've seen it firsthand, then you know how horrific it is. And it tends to be, you know, the politicians who've never seen a day of battle who are real, you know, they're like, yes, I want to prove my manhood from the safety
yeah.
of my office here.
Exactly. You know, it's like declaring war is like waving their dick around or something.
Yeah, and I said manhood, but they've actually shown that female presidents and prime ministers will do the same thing. It's like whomever, male or female, vagina or penis, trying to prove that they're macho.
Mm-hmm.
and apparently if you've actually done battle and seen it, then you're more conservative, trying to protect the lives of those soldiers.
Exactly.
But anyway, I was just going to say, it's a strange world to me that awards are routinely handed out to soldiers for taking lives, you know, in the defense of their country, obviously, and it does take a lot of bravery and a lot of courage. And again, no offense to that, but I just don't understand why I live in a culture where that's awarded, but if you give people orgasms, you go to jail.
Well, at least if you give them orgasms for money. It's
well,
like,
it depends.
George Collins said, you know, money's legal, sex is legal, you put the two of them together, and, you know, suddenly
and they're
you're
illegal.
Time.
I actually went to jail. I went to jail for trying to get somebody an orgasm for free.
Under what pretext?
I was
in public or something like that.
It was in public.
Oh, yeah,
still,
well.
I'm sorry, but soldiers don't kill the enemy in secret.
You won't get an argument from me. I think, you know, well, you know, protecting children from that, you know, until they're old enough to see something like that. But I think people should be able to walk around naked if they want. I think, yeah, they should be able to have sex.
That gets me really upset when we have to protect children from seeing sex. That's really interesting since you know, our ancestors had really small places to live in. So, like, Native Americans lived in longhouses if they were Iroquois, and other tribes
That's
lived
true.
In teepees.
That's true.
You know, there's been lots of people who grew up in poverty who had a one-room cabin, and they were making babies right and left. And somehow or another, nobody got traumatized. However,
that's a good point. But to get a neocon or one of these religious right wackos up in arms, you just got to mention the children. You know, like that's the magic talisman. That should get their blood boiling, and that's the excuse for everything.
But it's okay to show them violence. I mean,
of course. Well, you're just preparing them for manhood, you know.
If you want violence, you just open up the Bible.
Tell me about it.
I mean, I read the Bible from cover to cover when I was 12 years old, and then when I got to Revelations, at the final chapter of Revelations, I was hoping I was going to have this wonderful, you know, take me off to meet Jesus kind of feeling, like, oh, I've been transformed, I'm so inspired, I have faith. I really wanted that, you know. I wanted that religious experience. I felt like throwing up. And I couldn't figure out why. I thought, why does reading the Bible make me nauseous? There must be something wrong with me. I started to think I really was the daughter of Satan. And eventually I figured out it was because there was so much in there about hating women.
It's a horribly misogynistic book. And, well, really, all it's like even Judaism, which, you know, compared with Islam and Christianity is relatively benign, but even in Judaism I hear that, you know, that really devout Jewish men will wake up every morning or go to bed each night saying, thank you, God, for not making me a woman. It's like, what is...
Yes.
That's terrible. And yet women are the ones that bring life into this earth. Not me, clearly, because I don't have a uterus or ovaries, but women are the ones that bring life in here as close to a creative power, you know, that there is. And yet the Bible spends so much time putting women down and blaming Eve for original sin, and trying
to write women out of the procreative process, because it's so interesting. You're all those begats, and Adam begat blah blah blah, and Abraham begat blah blah blah. And that the women are just written out of the process of babies, which is just like it's science fiction, you know, that God the Father created mankind out of, you know, a rib cage. Woman comes out of man instead of man coming out of woman. It's just,
yeah, it's backwards, isn't it?
It's so much science fiction. And it's really a really obvious attempt to erase anything to do with the goddess. And I wish more Christians and Jewish people and I'm not so sure about Islam because it's a newer monotheistic religion, but the ancient religions like Judaism and Christianity really have their roots in goddess worship.
Well, and that's, my mother in 1995 gave me this great book. It's called The Myth of the Goddess. And it really changed my life because I am the product of parochial school. I went to this Episcopalian school, and then my parents got divorced, and then I went to, you know, public junior high, and it didn't take me long to just wash my hands of the whole God thing. And so to be ruthless with something like that, and I had this whole, what I call Christian paranoia hanging over me, like, what if they're right, and I've got to accept Jesus or I'm going to go to hell, and this and that. I mean, I really, yeah, at some level, at least subconsciously, I bought into that whole thing. And when I read Myth of the Goddess, that's when I learned that, well, Christianity, really, the Bible is plagiarized from Egyptian and Sumerian and Babylonian texts that predated it by thousands of years.
It's true.
It's a plagiarism. You know,
even the Jesus story starts in Egypt.
With Horus was the original savior.
My book that turned everything around for me was Merlin Stone's When God Was a Woman. I just, that book changed everything for me. And it's not that I don't, I mean, at this point now, for me, gender is sometimes kind of an irrelevant thing. I mean, sometimes I pray to God, sometimes I pray to Goddess. Most of the time I say God, Goddess, all that is when I pray. Mm-hmm. But it's embracing this missing feminine aspect of the divine and the feminine aspect of life here on planet Earth, period. Just embracing that and realizing that, I mean, I'm really sad for a lot of the young girls right now because it seems like they have been so molded into being like boys that we have lost so much about this other aspect of our beingness. You know, regardless of what your genitalia is, we need to be balanced human beings. And, you know, if all that you do is you know, deal in logic and try to, you know, repress your emotions as much as possible.
And the whole,
the whole
male competitive thing, you know, women
getting
into business and all that.
Everything's utilitarian. And the only way you cope with your emotions is through addictive behaviors. So it's either a video game or get drunk. God forbid you should cry.
Yeah, it's really sad. And it, I think if people could get really more back to the goddess, or not get back to it, but learn about it in the first place, learn about how, you know, the most civilized and advanced human societies back in Upper Paleolithic and Neolithic times worshiped goddesses, and they were conquered by the nomadic and warlike patriarchal god cultures who absorbed the goddess into their own religions. I mean, in Christianity we've got Mary, and well, Mary Magdalene to some degree too. That's how they preserved just enough of the goddess in there, and they did that to, I guess, as sort of a, you know, to placate the goddess worshiping peoples when Christianity was still a new religion.
Well, Constantine did that very deliberately because he was, you know, the emperor of Rome, and he was trying to get as many adherents to the Christian faith as possible. So he needed some way to merge paganism with Christianity. So that's why he went up with Easter, which is actually Ishtar, and in Christmas, you know, with the orbs, the fertility symbols hanging off the Christmas tree, which is another fertility symbol. None of this has anything to do with Jesus. But, boy, that is just fighting words here in America.
Oh, yeah. Well, and actually, I've heard there's some debate as to whether Constantine was a pagan who accepted Christianity because he did it to keep Rome from being torn in half.
Yeah.
Or that he was already always leaning Christian to begin with. I really like the first explanation, is that he was really a lifelong pagan and saw that he just wasn't going to beat these Christians out because they were nuts, because they were willing to be fed to lions and do whatever. You just couldn't win them. You just couldn't beat them. And so to keep Rome from being torn apart, he announced, "I am a Christian," and then went and formed the Council of Nicaea, and they gathered all the texts together and decided what to throw out and what to keep. And, you know, what we have today as the Bible is really just the result of man-made editing.
Oh, I know. And that's, you know, that to me is just so disturbing, that people actually think that they're, you know, that this
when people
is,
say it's God's Word. And it's like, it's not. all the people that wrote about Jesus, you know, they were writing about him like 50 years after he was dead.
Yes.
Paul, who wrote so many, Paul, a.k.a. Saul, who wrote Corinthians and all those other books in the Bible, never even met Jesus to begin with. He claimed to have seen him on the road and had a vision or whatever, and you know, Jesus told him what to write in all those books. But, I mean, none of those words are really attributed directly to Jesus. It's all Paul. We never even knew the man.
And Paul is the biggest misogynist of all.
Oh, God. Paul was probably closeted gay.
Didn't
he say it in one of his books that it's bad to touch a woman or something like that, or it's bad to be with a woman?
he said, I would prefer that you would live like I do, and I'm kind of using the newer translation, but instead of the these and thous, but, you know, I would prefer that you live like I do, which he was celibate. However, if you must, it's better to marry than to burn. So his whole thing was that it was really an odious task, this thing of having sex with women, and it was putting a lot of ground between you and God. You weren't going to be as close to God. You weren't going to be as good as he was, but at least you wouldn't be a fornicator.
Paul should have been Islamic. I mean, that sounds like something like right out of the Taliban or something.
Oh, and he was also the one who wanted women to be silent in church. He was the one that said women should submit themselves to their husbands, even as the church does under Christ. He was the one who said women needed to cover their heads when they went to church. I mean, he just had a long list of things. He was like, to me, a busybody little ninny who had a lot of spare time and a lot of resentments and bitterness, you know? Just a really bitter old man. and why we can't
much like the government
that?
That we just got rid of.
Uh-huh, exactly. Exactly. Drill, baby, drill. I mean,
oh, don't even get me going on that. Don't even get me going.
Oh, come on. I want to get you going. Show me what you got.
Okay, good. Okay, good. Well, it's like I am so thrilled that each new little bit of news that comes out of Alaska, it's like, you know, when I heard that Levi Johnston's, was it his mom was arrested for selling, you know, Vicodin and oxycodone. It's like,
yes.
Oh, and it's like, yes, yes, Sarah Palin pals around with drug dealers. and then her sister-in-law was arrested breaking and entering twice into the same house.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not. It's like up in Alaska, it's like one big issue episode of Cops up there. And then Levi Johnston decided he's not going to marry Bristol after all. Yeah, he probably made that decision like 60 seconds after, you know, after the returns came in on election night. He said, okay, whew, I guess I don't got to marry this bitch after all. So, and I don't feel one bit sorry for her either. You know, she's the one, she knew, you know, that all this stuff could come up. She knew what kind of family that she had. She's not a stupid woman. What she is an opportunist, a highly ambitious opportunist had a single brain in her head who believes that the earth is 6,000 years old and Jesus is gonna appear in Alaska or whatever, and that's gonna the place to be during the end times. And the thought of somebody like that running our government scares the piss out of me.
Well, I just you know what? I'll tell you something. I really felt proud of my country because we didn't elect those people. Up until Obama won the election, I just started thinking, you know, this country has got 1 in 100. That's 1 out of every 100 citizens behind bars. This country has got one of the highest murder rates in the world. This country is so violent. And you know, we constitute a small portion of the planet, but we're taking up most of the resources. And you know, now, especially the documents that are out, you know, confirming that, in fact, we did torture our prisoners. It was just becoming very, very difficult to feel any faith or pride in my country. And when I saw that the Republican Party was running their platform on nothing but hate and gossip and sarcasm
and
negativity, it was just shocking to me. I thought, oh my God, are these the people I'm sharing this country with? So when I saw that, no, there actually are a majority of people who would like something more sane, more loving, more life-affirming, more positive.
Less greedy, less corrupt. I mean,
yeah.
Mark Foley is something of old news. I mean, that was several years ago. Mark Foley, Republican congressman from Florida, who was this big family values type. Really heavy. He's, for instance, you're familiar with the porn, what the hell is the licensing thing? My mind's totally gone blank. 2257. You know, familiar 2257.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, he's one of the people behind that and behind all this family value stuff. And then it turns out he's having sex with male congressional pages. These are minors, you know. He's having sex with these underage boys in Congress. And then, of course, Larry Widestance Craig, you know, tapping his toe there in the airport men's room.
Well, of course.
And then Ted Haggard. Then Ted Haggard, of course.
Ted Haggard.
The methamphetamine snorting, you know, gay male prostitute, patronizing hypocrite.
I just saw a documentary of him on the documentary channel last night. I just watched like 5 minutes of it. And it's like a reality documentary. They're following him around. He's completely ostracized from his church, and he's begging them to take him back. And it's really pitiful. And, of course,
I don't feel a bit sorry for him, because he was one of the people that supported Mark Foley and all of his family friends.
Oh, yeah.
He really believes
his own bullshit, because he thinks he's going to cure himself of being homosexual. That's the whole thing, and he's gone on all these TV shows trying to say, you know, it's a choice, and I don't have to behave like this. And
now he's talking about choice now. Before it's like, I'm not gay, but now it's a choice. So he's copping to it.
Well, I think
he's
admitting that he has engaged in homosexual behavior. What's interesting?
When did this come out?
Probably, I'd say about 3 months ago.
Miss all the good stuff.
Yeah. Well, he was basically trying to have it both ways. It was that he's born this way. There's nothing he can do about it. He finally feels compassion for other gay people. However, as a Christian, he was going to make a choice not to engage in the behavior.
Yeah, except in airport bathrooms.
Is that messed up or whatever? And, I'm talking about... did you think I was talking about Larry? No. I'm not talking about Larry. I'm talking about...
I'm talking about Ted Haggard.
Ted's gone on to national TV with his wife and everything, saying...
That I knew about. Oh, God. Oh, damn.
Yeah.
I was really hoping that Larry Craig...
Are you kidding? Come on. Anybody who does that dance in the bathroom is going to do a dance around the topic.
That was clever. And then, of course, Ted Stevens. I'm so glad that Ted Stevens went down, too, because he's another one of these family values fucks. Ugh.
Well, I'm sure you had clients like this, too. I certainly have had my share of clients who were religious leaders, and, you know, they're out there at the pulpit preaching against whatever it is they're doing in private with me. seen it a lot of times.
Oh, did Jimmy Swaggart, you know, Jim Baker. Oh, God. Those were the days. I love the 80s.
It happens so much, it's not even news. You know what, though? I mean, it's brilliant. A lot of people that I love are devout, even conservative right-wing Christians. Okay, let me rephrase that. I really love my mother, and she's a conservative right-wing Christian. And then I have some other friends who are Christian, but they're pretty liberal. So I guess it's not a lot of people. But, you know, I try to have respect for people's faith and not speak out against that in particular. One of the things, though, that I find really disturbing, no matter how much I care about, you know, the people that I love who happen to consider themselves Christian, is that it seems like, for some of them, if they happen to belong to the right-wing branch of the religion, there is actually a huge acceptance of dishonesty. And, you know, I think about my mother, and again, she's one of my best friends. I love her dearly, but I am just shocked at how much energy she will put into trying to make sure the people in her church don't find out. And, of course, in this case, she doesn't want the people in her church to find out about her daughter, me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, well, she raised me to be honest. And, you know, one of my favorite sayings is the truth is always better. And, of course, as you know, I'm in 12-step recovery, and my life hinges on rigorous honesty. You know, if I'm not rigorous, honest.
Honesty, open-minded, missing willingness, absolutely.
Yeah. So it just, it baffles me. I go, how is it that this woman is the one who raised me? I don't get it. You know, look at her. She just goes around lying and hiding stuff. And to her, this is a good Christian life. It just,
it really baffles me. And I kind of understand where she's coming from, because, once again, it's ingrained in our culture. This country was founded by Puritans. This country was founded by people that were so afraid of God that they knew that they were all going to hell if they stayed in England and submitted to the Church of England, because that was, you know, the infidels, and so they moved over here so they could practice their religion. At least the very founders did, the Puritans. And then the founding fathers came in, and guys like Thomas Jefferson, I think what Thomas Jefferson said, there is nothing more perverted in the world than Christianity. Ben Franklin, of course, had nothing good to say about religion. A lot of the founding fathers knew just how dangerous religion could be to the very principles of our Constitution. And yet, look what's happened to us. I mean, starting with Jerry Falwell, who, you know, his silent majority helped put Reagan in office the first time, and ever since Falwell realized that, hey, if we can organize all these churches, we can do more than just pray and help the needy. We can actually change the laws and get people elected that think the way we think. And from that point on, that was how all politicians, to some degree, had to at least a little bit kowtow to the religious right, or at least risk avoid alienating them. And it's really sad that's the way it is. But I think finally they've gotten so big for their britches. You know, because George Bush was their orgasm. That was the peak of their potency. I don't know if you saw the story in 2004 how Bush declared a war on condoms.
Well, no. I just know that the Pope recently said condoms can't prevent the transmission of HIV.
Well, a real scientist there. Google this, and actually have your listeners do this, because this is a Google Bush condom wars, and there is something that appeared in the LA Weekly. It didn't get a lot of play at the time, but what happened was the CDC changed their rules so that any provider, counseling service, public health, women's health, anything like that, that got even one federal dollar, even if it had nothing to do with family planning or STDs or anything, if they even mentioned the word condom or safer sex or anything other than abstinence, they'd lose their federal funding. It's outrageous. Yeah. This was in mid-2004. And that was Bush's big gift, you know, to the religious right that got him in office there. And then, of course,
well,
you know,
and as Sarah Palin so aptly illustrates with her own family, our teen pregnancy rate has also gone sky high.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, the religious right basically decided that we were going to teach abstinence only to our children. So now the nation is having a huge epidemic with teen pregnancy.
Teen pregnancies, STDs are on the rise, too. And this all started with Bush. It was actually teen pregnancies and STDs were on a decline until Bush took office. And then, especially after they changed the rules about, you know, threatening health centers to take their federal funding away if they promoted condom use or even mentioned them to their clients. I was outraged to read it. How come this isn't getting any play? How come nobody is doing anything?
I know. Well,
the LA Weekly.
Sex is still this big taboo. I have seen a couple of glimmers of hope, though. Oprah Winfrey's been talking about sex a lot. As a matter of fact, she had Dr. Laura Berman on her show about a week ago recommending that mothers go out and buy their daughters vibrators.
Wow. Well, there must be a new administration in town.
I'm telling you. And, you know, there were a lot of shocked people in the audience. And then Oprah tried to backpedal and say, you're just a guest on my show. I'm not endorsing this. But still, I was saying, okay, Oprah, cover your butt however you have to. We all know you knew what she was going to say.
Well, and Oprah's had more and more, you know, transgenders, you know, transsexual people as guests. I mean, this really bodes well for when I actually get my book out there. I mean,
She had the pregnant man on.
Yeah. Thomas Beattie spells his name differently, but, you know, no relation. But, I'm working with a real, you know, the real deal kind of literary manager. This is someone that's a real professional, and she sees that there's mass market potential for my book. So I'm planning on being on Oprah anyway. Let's just put it that way.
Well, you and me both, baby. I made the mistake of turning Oprah down about 10 years ago. I didn't have a book to sell. I was just a high-priced escort at that time, and I was into making money, and she doesn't pay for her interviews. So I was like, wow. Last TV show I did, they gave me $2,000. I'm not going to go do Oprah. They're probably just going to hang me out to dry anyway. And, of course, you know, she had Marianne Macy on there talking about her new book, and all the women in the audience stood up and said that they were for legalizing prostitution. I felt like such an idiot for not going.
Well, you know how those things are going to go. I was on Montana Williams in 93. And it was Sweeps Week, of course, and they had this gorgeous college-age woman, you just the heartbreaker. You never would have guessed she was a $500-an-hour escort, and her boyfriend on there who basically, and the audience just savaged them. Then there was this streetwalker that was streetwalker/escort. She was funny. She was like this sense of humor. And then there was another girl who was just an escort. She only went out to dinner with her clients. She would, of course, never have sex with them. And they had me as a former prostitute. And Montel held it back from the audience that I was transsexual. And I added myself. And the audience was like, whoa. You know, they couldn't believe it. It was a great moment for me, you know, to pass in front of, you know, 10 million people or whatever.
That's nice.
But the point is that they savaged this one young woman, and then the escort who swore up and down no, she didn't have sex with the clients, and it's just in general, it wasn't a sex worker friendly show. I mean, they pretty much left me alone because they had no idea. I'd blown them away so much they had no idea what to say, you know, to me. So
and this is Montel Williams. I'm surprised.
This is Montel is so cool. He is so cool.
I think so.
Yeah.
His was the very first talk show I ever did. And,
What was the topic?
It was prostitution. It was married prostitutes. So they had Nina Hartley and Dave Hartley were on there. For the listeners who don't know, Nina Hartley's a very famous porn star.
Oh, no, I know Nina. I've met Nina.
I met her in a limo on our way to the green room to get all dressed up and get our makeup and hair done for the Montel Williams show.
When was it? Because I remember...
1991.
I remember there was a... It was probably, maybe it was in 92 or 93. There was a coyote panel that was taking place at the Women's Building in the Mission. I remember Nina was there for that. And I was covering it for Spectator. And you were there. I remember Nina Hartley picked you up. She swept you off your feet. I remember that. It's like...
She's such a sweetie. One time she was headlining over at Mitchell Brothers, and I was sitting in the front row, and she pulled me up and gave me a long, passionate kiss as part of her show. I remember it was the softest pair of lips I've ever kissed.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Those are the softest lips I have ever kissed, Nina Hartley.
Wow.
Yeah, she's kind of a kisser. But, yeah, she's fun. And we had a lot of fun on the Montel Williams show. And Montel was very, very sweet to us. Of course, the audience, you know, the talk show format was always about hanging you out to dry.
Well, one thing about Montel is he's educated. He understands, you know, he's definitely understood, you know, the issue. He's educated himself, and he asked intelligent questions. And
he does. He's a kind man. Well, you know, we're getting close to time to get out. Oh, actually, you know what? We started late here. So we've got another 10 minutes. But I do want to make sure that we get a chance to promote your band and your book and anything else that you want to promote. So maybe this would be a good time for you to tell people how they can get in contact with you and what your website address is and all that stuff.
Okay. Well, first of all, the band is no more. I hung that up in 2002 when I turned 44.
Don't tell me it has anything to do with your age. I have an ex-boyfriend who just got his first music video, and he's over 60, so give me a break.
Well, let's put it this way. You know, when you've got to get up at 8 in the morning to do your corporate job, those 3 a.m. bedtimes that up-and-coming, you know, hopeful rock bands, you know, you've got to get these late hours because you got to be out and socializing and promoting yourself, and it was just really, really wearing on me. And we've been doing Glamazon since we played our first gig at Bottom of the Hill in San Francisco in 95. And
okay.
After 7 years, for our first gig, had a packed house, too. We really lucked into that gig. But it's like after 7 years, you know, we'd recorded a CD, we started recording another one, and yeah, there was a lot of tension between my partner and I. It just got to a point where it's like, this isn't fun anymore. I don't think, you know, I'm just not hopeful that we're going to do anything with this. So.
Okay. Well,
yeah,
I know you've got a great website, though, with videos.
Well, let's see now. I've got my main website is glamazon.net. GLAMAZON. Just think of Amazon with a GL, you know, glamorous in front of it. Glamorous Amazon, glamazon.net. Not .com. That's a whole story behind .com. But that's not me. It's glamazon.net. That's my main website. And then from there, you can get a link to my YouTube site, my YouTube page. And then I'm out there on Facebook, too. Christine Beattie on Facebook. And I've also got MySpace. I hardly go over on anymore because MySpace is basically a big meat market. I'm happily seeing somebody, so I'm not.
How long now?
I'm sorry?
How long have you been seeing somebody?
Oh, I've been seeing her for about 2 years.
So you're a lesbian.
I'm technically bisexual.
Are you?
Yeah, but I mean, come on, Veronica, I was hitting on you when we were in Tacoma together. You remember that, please.
I know, but that wasn't that before your surgery?
Yeah, that was before the surgery.
Yeah,
it was really more lonely than horny. It's like I wanted a girlfriend. I didn't want to lay. I was like, you were like so cool. Well, you still are really cool, intelligent.
Thank you, sweetheart.
You're just like, this is the kind of girlfriend I'd like. You know, you're gorgeous, you're highly intelligent, you're fun, you've got a great spirit, you're spiritual, and you're in recovery. I mean, it's like, God, you were the total package. So, of course,
God, you are so sweet. You're so
well,
sweet.
Well, I'm so glad we get to be friends here because, I mean, you know, we can definitely do some activism kind of stuff and more rabble-rousing, you know, in the future, because that's my whole thing, is to be a thorn in the side of the religious right.
Well, I applaud you and support you in your quest.
I think it's a very worthy cause.
And when I come down to L.A., I want to see you, and let's go to a meeting together, you know?
That would be cool. That would be great. Or, do you smoke? I'm sure remember if you ever smoked or not.
No, I quit drinking, September 4th of 1985. And I quit cigarettes, about a year and a half later in November. I always forget that date, but it was like November of, I guess, 7, something like that.
Well, yeah, I got clean and sober in August of 88, man. I got into the relationship from hell, and I got away from the meetings, and so I relapsed in 92, and then came back for good March of 97, and in June of 2003, I hung up the cigarettes. It was like 2 weeks before I started interferon.
Good for you.
Yeah,
good
well,
for you.
I got
what,
Hep C.
Is,
that's,
and now that's for the interferon.
Hepatitis C.
Yes, hepatitis C.
Right. Cause,
which you have been cured of, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, I was just out there, I was, you know, shooting drugs in the 80s and in the mid-80s, and there's one little souvenir I picked up from that. And so I finally did the interferon thing. I got cured of it, and I quit smoking, you know, all at once. So I plan on being around for a while.
Well, and I know you will, honey. I just saw you on YouTube, and you look gorgeous and young and vibrant, and so I think that's awesome. I had a friend, actually, who had to take that medicine for Hep C, and he came out of it okay, but it's really hell while you're doing it, isn't it?
Oh, God, it was awful. I mean, I used to wake up in the morning and feel like I'd been super glued to my mattress. It was like, and then
wow.
Like a third of my hair fell out, and I was going through, I mean, I've never, like, really been clinically depressed before in my life, and I got to this point where it's like, I was grateful that I had cats because it was my, look, because I had cats, I couldn't kill myself because I'd leave my cats without a mommy. So, yeah, so my cats actually got me through that, and I got on an antidepressant and, you know, managed to make it all just the full 11 months of treatment, so.
You never met Rod Coe, did you?
Hmm?
Did you ever meet Nikki and Rod? Rod and Nikki?
It sounds a little familiar. San Francisco?
She was an escort, and he was her husband, and he and she and my husband and me, we all, the four of us, formed a company called Wildside Productions, where we made pornographic movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all in the program. All clean.
I think that's great. You know, that's it. It's like you can do anything in sobriety as long as you follow the basic principles of being honest, open-minded, and willing. As long as you're living your life by a spiritual basis and following your conscience and doing all that stuff, you can do anything. Because
so many people in the sex industry, or either providers or customers, who are clean and sober and living a spiritual life.
Actually, one of my best friends down here is a porn star, and she's like totally cool, and I know her from the program. So
yeah.
I can't say her name because I just said she's.
Well,
on the
exactly. Exactly. And the only reason I mention Rod's name is because he's passed on. So otherwise I would not mention, and Nikki, that's a pseudonym. It's not her real name. So
well, I mean, in my book I mentioned that I got clean and sober via 12-step programs, but as long as I'm not mentioning specific fellowships, then I'm not violating any tradition.
Well, that's what I do too. One time a reporter went and put the name of the 12-step program on there, not a particular fellowship, but a particular,
mm-hmm.
And it wound up on Salon, and I got some nasty emails from people, and I'm like, but that's not what I said. They weren't supposed to write that. So,
you're always going to get that. I mean, some people, they just live to be upset. They don't. They're not alive. They don't feel alive unless they're getting upset about something.
That's true. That's true, sweetheart. Well, I suppose I better wrap this up now. I got to tell you, honey, I love you. I miss you. I'm so glad we got a chance to reconnect. And I thank you for sharing your story. You know, my apologies to the listeners if you were hoping that we would all sit here and talk about how Christine decided that she was a woman and not a man. I know we disappointed you.
Go to my website. There's a ton of information there. Pictures,
yeah.
Before, after, and during.
It's,
you know,
my hope, because it's 2009 that maybe we can finally grow up a little bit and just realize that we're all people.
That would be nice.
That's the real deal.
And I'd say I'd drink to that, but it would have to be sparkling cider.
Yeah, cheers. I'll have all some sparkling cider with you, too. And you be sure and let me know when your book is ready to come out, and we will have you back to talk about it, okay?
That would be great. Oh, it's so great to talk with you, and let's definitely stay in touch, hon.
We will, babe.
All right. Thanks so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
No, thank you. I love you. Talk to you soon.
I love you too, babe. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak muncul kabar berita?